Welcome to the NCO Journal podcast. This is a podcast series where we discuss published articles with authors and provide a forum for the open exchange of ideas, information, and solutions. I'm your host, Staff Sergeant Brandon Cox, the NCOIC of the NCO Journal, and Chago Zapata, the managing editor. Today we discuss the article, Adapt, Lead, Win, NCO Lessons from Ukraine, by Sergeant Major Beware Langham. Unfortunately, the author could not be present with us today, but we have special guests, Command Sergeant Major Jason Duncan, a Battalion CSM Development Course instructor at the School for Command Prep in Fort Leavenworth, and special guest, Sergeant First Class Marcel Blood, the Deputy Director of the Harding Project. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. First, we're going to kick things off by having Sergeant Major Duncan tell us a little bit about himself.
Yeah, sure. Grateful to be here. It's a good opportunity. I've been a soldier since 1998. I joined the Army and as an infantryman. My first duty station was Fort Campbell, Kentucky, where I basically cut my teeth as an infantryman. And I've had various locations and have served in various leadership positions since that time. Ultimately, right now I'm at the School for Command Prep, where I'm an instructor for the Battalion Command Sergeant Major Development Course. And over here at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, love and life.
It's awesome, Sergeant Major. Thank you for joining us. And Sergeant Blood, could you please tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Sergeant Blood. Appreciate the introduction. So I had kind of a weird way that I grew up in the Army. I went to base training in 2011. I went to EOD school after that. So EOD is my primary job before I took the deputy director position at the Harding Project. But at the EOD schoolhouse, I went to selection for the 28th EOD at Fort Liberty and then spent 10 years there. It's pretty uncommon for people to spend that much time in one unit. And the fear is always that you get kind of a one-sided look at the Army, which for me is probably good because I got the best look at it. And now I'm pretty much dedicated to this for the rest of my life, which is great. From there, I went out to do my charter time, spent 1 year at the battalion running the battalion training cell. That was the 192nd EOD battalion. And then wrote an article at SLC. It was on 3D printing. That got recognized by the chief of staff of the Army. And then ultimately, I got the invite to take the deputy director spot here, which has been a wild ride so far. I've been in the seat for about a month and a half. I took the position from Sergeant First Class Summerlin. If you know anything about him, he did a phenomenal job, left me huge shoes to fill, and I'm just out here doing my best.
Great. Thank you for joining us. Today is a little bit interesting because, we don't have the author joining us who wrote the original article, but it is essentially about the ongoing conflict between Russia forces and Ukraine forces and kind of the NCO's role for the Ukrainian army that held now that vital role to the battlefield, and kind of the technology aspect in that too. So we're just kind of talk about some of that. I don't know if you guys had some key takeaways, something you want to jump off with here.
I think my first thought when I reflected through the article was in my career, this is the first time that I can think of, other than Crimea or Georgia, where we can be an outsider looking in at a large-scale combat operation happening right before our very eyes, and where we can take these lessons learned, whether it's about what technology is being used, what the battlefield looks like, how the non-commissioned officers for the Ukrainian Army are operating under mission command. I just think it's a unique experience that we can, or a unique thing that's happening where we can have a great takeaway and learn from it as we prepare to fight our next war.
So what do you think, Sergeant Major Duncan, are a couple of things maybe that you've viewed or noticed about the war?
Well, I think as I was a onlooker watching this unfold as Russia was moving towards Ukraine and we kind of all knew what was about to happen, just the kind of the signs and signals that were being manifested. And then when it all happened, just watching everything on the news and seeing how much of a difficult time Russia was having and continues to have, where they thought they were going to go through very quickly and seize Ukraine in a very timely manner. but that has not come to fruition. So the main thing that I've taken away is Ukraine with their non-commissioned officers and their lessons learned from Georgia or the Crimea and their development of their non-commissioned officer corps has ultimately stopped that or has stifled that movement and made it more difficult for Russia. And that's one takeaway that I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like you were saying, the Ukrainians had a massive undertaking by Russia coming to the border, you know, boosting those troops. Because in the article, it said that there were over 190,000 Russian forces at the border ready to attack at any moment. And then they were trying to take the capital city. That had to be extremely overwhelming for Ukraine. And I can only imagine that the soldiers there not have ever fought this type of war before, had to come up with a lot of creative solutions on the battlefield and things like that, you know, being put that risk into their hands, like you have to make a decision. The time is now. That had to be very overwhelming. Do you have anything you want to add to that, Sergeant Blood?
Absolutely. So I think it's important to realize too, and to remember that this is really our one look through the magnifying glass at LISCO. We don't really have many examples of it, maybe none, right? Sergeant Major of the Army Weimer, he writes in his Muddy Boots article that none of our senior leaders have any experience fighting in LISCO. And if you think back, like, that's true. We've been fighting the GWAT forever. A lot of people have combat experience, but no one really has war experience. So this is our snapshot into it. I remember right before, maybe the day before the invasion happened, I was in Washington, the state, not the district. I was in Washington with 275, and we were on a prepare to deploy order there. Right, we're ready just in case something happened, and nobody thought it was going to happen. Right, if you look back, you know, if you think back to what we were all thinking at the time, it was like, yeah, this is, you know, posturing, it's political, it's all that stuff. And then we got notice that they started like moving blood reserves to the front. And if you think about it, and they were moving a lot of, you know, reserve blood for like medical purposes. And if you think about it, like, those have an expiration date. So they're not just doing that to do it, or they're not just doing it as an exercise. And then, so we saw that and we're like, oh, that's, you know, that's interesting. And then they invaded like right afterwards. So knowing what those key things are that happen in a near LISCO fight, all right, 'cause there's some questions back and forth on whether this truly represents LISCO, and it represents it more than any other example that we have. So then knowing those key landmarks, those are going to serve us well in the future.
You know, it's not just LISCO, by the way. It's also multi-domain. You know, it's like, I think probably one of the, well, according to some of the other articles that I read, it's also the Gulf War in 91 was the first space, use of space. But with this one, using satellite communications and all the different things that come along with that, this is a very unique snapshot into the way that one of our biggest adversaries, you know, fights and, you know, makes war, and they're not just their way to learn their tactics and that sort of thing. So I think this is a good opportunity. This article and is a good opportunity for NCOs to learn about our enemy, or to learn about one of our biggest adversaries, you know, to be prepared to fight in the future, whether we, you know, fight them or not. I think it's important to know our adversary and to know how they fight so that we can be prepared. And I think that's one of the biggest takeaways from this article that I got, is that, you know, NCOs can't just sit on their laurels. They can't just sit and wait and then handle things when it happens. They have to prepare now. They have to learn from others, you know, others' lessons. And right now it's the Ukrainian armed forces who are going to teach NCOs the lessons. And I think it's important that that this article is something that anybody who listens to this podcast, or who reads our work, our published articles, challenges their young soldiers to read and to be familiar with our adversary. So that's kind of one of my biggest things that I wanted to take away from this.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it just makes me think about, again, you know, when I sit back and and we're observing this in the Ukrainian armed forces, the adaptability, you know, is there, and that's got to be through the non-commissioned officers that are on the ground, and because they're using old equipment and they're using new equipment, and they're adapting to what they have, and they're making it very effective. And even to the point now where, you know, AI technology is being utilized with the drones, as it mentions in the article, which is just amazing to me. And, you know, it draws a picture of what our next war could look like. You know, I mean, we see it happening before our very eyes. So we need to be ready. We need to be continuing to develop ourselves and as non-commissioned officers and developing our future non-commissioned officers.
One of the things too that to think about, and you said it, Sergeant Major, is that you know, it allows us to look and see what's going on, and it's not a luxury that we had, like say in 2003 when I deployed to Iraq or to Kuwait and then pushed up into Iraq. Back in 2003, we didn't have the luxury of being able to look everything up on our phones and dig things up on the internet and watch things happening live and see all the things and learn all the things that are happening that you're able to do now because of technology, social media, and all the advancements that are out there. So this is a unique opportunity, I think, that all NCOs should take advantage of. That if you don't, and if you don't challenge your NCOs to look at this, or to your soldiers, not your NCOs, but all your soldiers, to look at what's going on and learn from it and take lessons from it, then I think that you're doing them a disservice.
Yeah. I think one of my biggest takeaways when I was reading it was I was very interested by the fact that the Ukrainian army didn't necessarily have the best NCO corps, but yet they found that it was necessary to develop and train a very professional NCO corps to be able to have success. And I thought that was interesting. Do you have something on that, Sergeant Major?
Yeah, no, that's one takeaway I had as well. One of the lessons learned from the Crimea in Georgia was they needed a non-commissioned officer corps, and they needed to execute mission command. And since 2014, I mean, really, it's amazing what they've accomplished in that time frame. So if you take, 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine, from 2014, the few years that they had to develop those non-commissioned officers or their programming and education is really amazing what they were able to accomplish. And the results are ultimately manifested today, again, by the difficulty that Russia has in seizing their objective.
Now, I know that we haven't necessarily fought a LISCO war in a very long time, and they are now doing that. I'm going to kind of put you on the spot, Sergeant Major. What do you think are the major important things when you bring in a professional NCO corps and you give our mission command principles in that aspect? Why is that important that you have both?
For mission command, the one thing about mission command is you have a disciplined initiative, right? And you have a mutual trust. And with disciplined initiative, your non-commissioned officers have to be developed and have the experience or the understanding of what needs to be accomplished. And that happens through formal education, through your institutional domains, through your operational domain education, and also through your self-development. And so I think that is very key.
Mission command, isn't it taught at all, like all levels of professional military education, like BLC, ALC, SLC? It's like a part of the NCO Common Core competencies, right? So it's something that, you know, that the NCOs throughout the Army have at some point touched on and are aware of and employ pretty much on a daily basis, depending obviously on your MOS. But I imagine that, you know, having an NCO corps, the Ukrainian Armed Forces having an NCO corps that has that kind of training, that has that kind of that's been taught the principles of mission command, I think it's a force multiplier for them. But ultimately, when we are talking about our NCOs here and the principles of mission command, knowing and going back to everything that's happening here in Ukraine with the Russian with Russia attacking them, learning how they do what they do, and because at some point you may be involved, you may be in combat, you may be in whatever the case may be, and you will have to be able to employ, to use that disciplined initiative that you were talking about, Sergeant Major, and be trusted by the commander to do what needs to be done because you have an understanding of what his intent is. If you know your adversary somewhat and you're able to, and you're empowered, which I think ultimately what we're talking about here is empowering, that the Ukrainian army empowered their NCOs the way that the U.S. Army empowers its NCOs. So now I think it's important that reiterating the fact that they need to, you know, NCOs need to know their adversary, and what better way to learn about them than to see what's going on out there in the battlefield.
Yeah, and a great example of that, if I could share an experience, was my second deployment to Iraq in 2005. I was in a mounted unit, or an armored unit. We had Bradleys and we had Humvees. And so when we got to Baghdad, what we did was we had our Humvee unit, or a Humvee section, and we had our Bradley section. Bradleys basically stayed on the checkpoints while I was on the Humvees, and we would do our patrols through whatever sector we were doing that day. And, you know, the way it worked out for personnel, in order for us to have a decent rotation where we could have rest and be able to eat, you know, and be fully recuperated for the next patrol, it was the mounted section would stay with the platoon sergeant, the sergeant first class, and then a sergeant first class as your senior section leader. And then myself and the PL would alternate the patrols. And so the PL would go on a patrol for 12 hours. And then, you know, I would be prepping for the next patrol. And I was a staff sergeant, you know, leading these patrols. And so I was leading complete patrols in Iraq, utilizing mission command. Talk about disciplined initiative and mutual trust from your command, right? Going out there and with about 12 personnel and 4 vehicles, and really getting into it over there in Iraq and Baghdad in 2005. What a great opportunity that was for me and for all of us, and a learning experience. And I think that right now, you know, if we were to go into Ukraine, we would see stuff like that, or, you know, a staff sergeant equivalent to their staff sergeant leading those patrols and leading those things. And it's really necessary. And it is, like you said, to your point, a force multiplier. And that's why the non-commissioned officer is really the backbone of the Army. And you know, the dismounts, or you know, we can become a very casualty producing weapon when we're able to multiply like that.
I would ask Sergeant Major, because you're talking about an experience that required you to have a level of expertise, right, and experience in your field that you've now had, and then your command completely trusted that experience for you to be able to do that and lead that. What do you think currently, like if we go over there right now as like a battalion CSM, what would be the first things that you'd tell your NCOs that don't have this experience that may be put in this situation? And how would you train them, or what would you tell them? Yeah.
The first thing is you have to be a very disciplined unit. You know, it's really easy to go out there and, you know, when you're leading, and if you don't have the discipline to do the right thing, and that goes through, you know, you're disciplined through your standards, right? You got to have that to be successful. That's where the trust comes from. So you got to have the trust of your command. And you just, the basics, you have to know the basics. It's really simple. For us, it was knowing our battle drills, how to react to an ambush, how to enter and clear a room, right? Or enter a building and clear a room. All of those things, it was really not complicated. We would focus on the basics, and then the troop leading procedures and the 8-step training model were something that in that situation, we were very focused on. And when we would go outside the wire, it was game on. We were professionals, and we represented the United States of America. And, you know, we, as a leader, I had young soldiers with me. I had to instill that in them because these guys were go-getters. Sometimes I had to pull them back because they wanted to go, go, go. And it wasn't that, at that time wasn't appropriate. So that maturity as a leader, right, I was able to identify that and pull them back and then, or press them to go when we had to. So again, the lessons learned in that for me personally were great and something that I carry forward continuing with this day.
Yeah. I was wondering if Sergeant Blood has an experience that you could share.
Yeah. So I had the, you know, I had the opportunity to grow up in the Army in special operations. And, you know, as this conversation here has developed with all of us, going back to the point that Sergeant Major Duncan brought up about the basics, one thing that people kind of misunderstand about SOF is they think that all of their tasks are spent doing these like high level events and, you know, doing these crazy live fires and like all this stuff that nobody has access to, right? Because of the level of technical proficiency or the money or whatever it is, right? But my experience, although there were events like that where we did really cool, stuff. My background's EOD, so I remember one where we carried these Zodiac 510s down to the water, and we rode them out into the water, and we did a, and this is training, by the way, this isn't real life, but we did this hostage rescue of a bomb on the back of a kayak and somebody in it and the waves are, so a lot of different stuff, right? Very, very complex. And then we had to rescue them and had to think about it kind of atypically to be successful because, oh, by the way, it's a competition between us and the other teams. We also won. I want to throw that out there too. My team won, no big deal. So what ends up happening is you end up training the basics, right? Let's say you're on a flat range. You do your flat range stuff and then you do it at night and then you do it when it's cold out, when it's raining out, you do it when it's hot out, you do it underground, you do it in a, you know, simulated seaburn environment. And then you go back to doing it during the day and you find that you are way better at that than the average, the average troop. But you haven't really done any crazy next level stuff. It's all about exercising those basics under every condition and doing them regardless of what the situation is, just being an absolute expert. There's an anecdote, quote from somebody that says, you don't want to practice until you're, actually somebody else, I'm gonna have to tag somebody else in here, but, it's something about training it until you can't mess it up, right? It's not really about doing it perfectly. It's about training it until you can't mess it up. There's probably a ton of like war stories and whatever, but really the foundation of it is training the standard in as many conditions as you can so that you can execute them perfectly every time without messing them up.
No, I think you bring up a great point because if you train your soldiers in any environment during day, night, in any weather, maybe with some missing equipment or extra equipment, whatever the situation is, they can perform. So if it's a LISCO environment or we're going to Russia or we're going to Ukraine or we're going to Iran or whatever it is, they'll be able to perform. And I think that's the takeaway from what you said.
Yeah. When you're in a large scale combat operation, you don't want to find yourself in a situation where you're saying, wow, I should have trained for that a little bit more.
Yeah.
We have that opportunity every day, you know, and that's what non-commissioned officers do. We're the experts in training. And we identify based on our metal task what we need to do, or the commander will let us know, you know, the metal task we understand, and we know how to get after that. And a lot of times with resourcing or time, we may say, oh, we don't have the time to do that, or we don't have the resources. It really doesn't take a lot when you do the basics. I mean, how hard is it to take your squad outside at night under limited visibility in difficult terrain and try to stay in a wedge formation, or understanding when you go from a wedge to a file, or try to rally or put people in a patrol base? That is something that is not hard or heavily resourced to do as a training event, but is a critical skill to do, right, for survival in a large-scale combat operation. So just all those types of things, if there's non-commissioned officers out there listening, I just highly encourage, take that kind of, you know, do that kind of training all the time. It's really not too hard or difficult.
You know, that kind of leads, I'd like to kind of switch gears here a little bit, but one of the things that I want to talk technology, right? I think it's important that we talk technology. That's part of the thing that the author talked about. You know, there's drone warfare, there's AI being used, there's all kinds of things that he talks about. But going back to what you, Sergeant Major, and the you, Sergeant Blood, are talking about is, and what also the Sergeant Major of the Army and pretty much every Muddy Boots Command Sergeant Major who's written for our Muddy Boots page is saying is that you need to go back to the basics. You need to know the basics. You know, if you know, learning the basics when you're already out in the field, it's too late. You won't survive pretty much. So it's important to know the basics, to learn all your NCO competencies and soldier competencies. But when it comes to technology, I think it's just another tool that can be used for you to succeed. But there's a lot of tools out there. Some of them are being used extensively in Ukraine. And, you know, let's talk about drones. Again, that's one of the things that I pretty much we've published four articles so far from Muddy Boots, and I think pretty much all of them have talked about technology. The Futures Command Sergeant Major, you know, obviously that's his field and his particular baby, and I think it's important that soldiers, NCO soldiers, leaders, everybody look at what's going on out there in Ukraine and learn from it. But also start thinking beyond that, because by the time that we catch up with technology, technology's already gotten away from us. Kind of like the cell phone. You know, every year there's a new one with, you know, bigger, little fancier stuff. But that's what technology is. So you have to kind of continue to think, okay, this is what they're doing now. You know, I'll be leading troops out there maybe a year from now, maybe. Well, technology has gone further. So you need to start thinking beyond what you see now. There's, you know, from Futures Command, we published that Futures Command article, Command Sergeant Major, what is his name?
Hester.
Yep, right, Command Sergeant Major Hester's article. We put a picture of a robot dog in there, right? It's like, I think they call it the mule, or I don't know what they call that. But it's a robot dog that goes and tests the door before they went in and did their thing. So there's a lot of things, a lot of technology out there, you know, and I think it's important for NCOs to not just look at the things that are being employed in the war in Afghanistan. I'm sorry, in Afghanistan, in Ukraine. You know, right now there's drones that go and they'll drop a grenade or a bomb or something right inside of a tank hatch. Boom, tank's gone. Okay, that's fairly simple. But what else can you do? You know, some of them find the soldier directly. Some drones are big, some are small, some are like planes, some are like with, you know, have 8 rotors or 10 or however many. I mean, there's so many different things out there, along with the use of AI and I think one of the biggest other things that's being used out there is satellite communications. So again, you know, it's important to think outside the box, see what else. And then look beyond it so that you're able to kind of, when you're learning those basics, you're also exploring some of the more advanced stuff so that you're prepared for it. As an NCO, you have to be ready for things like that.
There's a, when I was at the 28th DOD, we would constantly talk about what the enemy is doing and then try to adapt to it. And we wouldn't only do that as a topic of conversation, we would also source or build in some cases. The tools that they were using to fight us. So for example, we were getting hit by a lot of like RPGs and stuff. And we kind of asked, you know, cause it's difficult to ask a room full of people like, hey, who doesn't know about this? Right. Cause there's a lot of people in there who are, who, you know, your perception of them is that they have seen everything, but, and it also takes an open, honest dialogue to say like, hey, maybe this is a gap in my knowledge. So what we found is maybe 4 of us out of the 20 had actually fired RPGs live. And actually understood what it was like to handle the weapon system and do it. So we said, okay, that's worth learning about, right? Shooting AKs, shooting RPGs, and really understanding the weapon system that's being used against us. So we were able to source some of them, order ammunition for them, and then go out and fire these weapon systems. And by using what the enemy is using, or maybe not using it because it's very resource intensive, what we did, it was important, but it probably cost a lot of resources. So the other thing I would challenge commands and people who are training troops is to use realistic training stuff from our adversaries and really make yourself make yourselves experts on the stuff that you'll be fighting and put yourself in the mindset. In EOD, we have this thing called a threat assessment, an EOD threat assessment. And what it is, it's putting yourself in the perspective of the bomber and saying, okay, if I was going to target me, how would I do it? And that has been very, very successful for us. We put ourselves in the perspective of the bomber and look at an area and say, well, the bomber is limited on resources just like we are. They can't put IEDs everywhere. Where would I put them if I was going to target myself? And then what happens 9 times out of 10 is they are exactly where you think they're going to be. And then what happens when they are there and you discover them is that reinforces that TTP for yourself. Yeah. So that's how we ended up doing EOD threat assessment and like planning against, you know, what the enemy was doing.
You know, drone, like just for example, drones, it's just changed the battlefield so much. And I'm just in awe when I see, I mean, you can see footage these days on the public domain, but you know, in 1998, if we wanted to find the enemy, we had to do what we call movement to contact. We had to get in a wedge or whatever the terrain was and move. And the goal was to make contact so we could gather intelligence of where our enemy was and how they were outfitted and what their, you know, what their posture was for or whatnot.
To seek out and destroy the enemy by fire.
Yeah. Whatever. Yeah, pretty much. And it goes a lot to what you say. We always pretty much, you could gather where they would be based on terrain. Right. You know, and that would be pretty easy. But nowadays the enemy could be, you know, a certain distance away, flying a drone and covering all that ground. And plus you have UAV and you have all that technology. So that just changes up so much. And right now that's what Ukraine is dealing with. And that's what the Russians are dealing with. And that's what we're going to have to deal with. And how are we going to deal with that? You know, that's something that we need to always be looking at as a leader, as a non-commissioned officer. How can I best have my soldiers survive that? It's amazing how much has changed.
Sergeant Major, so one thing that we found, you know, taking a very similar approach is we flew the drones when they first started popping up in Syria for one of my trips. We ended up sourcing some of the drones and flying them. It's the same thing as the RPG and AK example, but we flew them. We were able to see the video on like the thing. Then we had people go out and fire drone busters at them to see what the feedback is for the operator. I would fly them to the extent of their range and then see what happened, right? We would turn the controller off. We would do all kinds of stuff. We'd shoot them out of the air, like manually, like with a rifle, which is a lot more difficult than you'd expect. Cause we all think we're experts until we're shooting a little pinpoint in the sky. It's pretty tough. You kind of have to get lucky a little bit, but and then just to see what the extent of the technology is for the specific threat. That way you understand, you know, okay, we're seeing these types of drones. They're within eight, you know, the enemy, the operator of this is within 8K of us, or okay, they could be on the other side of the, you know, the planet and they're still running this technology. It's very, very good to know the capabilities of that technology. And the best way, in my opinion, to do it is to fly them. And if not their stuff, whatever we have access to, that's the closest, like have soldiers go out and fly drones. They will understand drones better. Go out and, you know, get on these like radio systems and do a comms check with the states if you're deployed, and you'll understand that better. SATCOM systems, everything, just go out and use it as close as you can to what our adversaries are using, and you'll understand them better and understand their capabilities. Then from there, you know, as a stepping stone, then you talk about our counterattacks for those things, and then you understand the whole kill chain, so to speak. And it's an enlightening moment for, you know, for an NCO, and then also as a soldier on the line, I think that'll yield a, you know, better result.
Yeah, no, that's definitely important. You know, as technology's been introduced to me as a U.S. soldier, right, as an infantryman, it's always been great, right? We've always loved it. And I always think about the very first piece of technology I came across that I thought was amazing was the plugger. And the pluggers basically was a big box thing with a big plastic antenna. And it was really your first GPS piece of equipment that a dismounted infantryman could use to get their MGRS grid, right? And I just thought that was amazing because now, really, I have a map. I don't need to use my protractor anymore. I could see where I'm at. So I only bring that up because sometimes in technology, we become so dependent on that and we have to be careful. So we have to stick with the basics as well. Because after the plugger came the dagger, and next thing you know, vehicles got Blue Force trackers, and you know exactly where you're at. But what happens when all that goes down? What happens, right? And I think we ask ourselves that question all the time. But are we prepared to deal with, you know, the inevitable if that technology is not available to us? What are we doing with as a non-commissioned officer corps to prepare our soldiers to, you know, for example, use land navigation? And I know that the operational units are doing land navigation. It's also in the institutional domains as well, training land navigation. But that's just one example. You know, that's pretty easy to see where technology is great, but it also can hinder our development as far as when it's not there, how can we overcome, right?
And it's developing so quickly and so much, and it's taking up so much of, you know, so many capabilities that I think that it's important that, you know, the different that soldiers don't use it, don't depend on it. Then it's not a crutch that without it they can't function. You know, ultimately that's exactly what you're saying. But I think it's but it's so much fun, and there's so much stuff that's happening out there. But again, just like you said, though, Russia has got a lot of similar capabilities to what we have. You know, and they are going to be able to counter a lot of the things that we, you know, that the U.S. develops. You know, there's things out there. I mean, I can, you know, you watch or read, watch movies or read about things like an electromagnetic pulse that, you know, cancels out any electronic device is pretty much toast. So then now you might be dismounted, no longer. Okay, I don't even think we have Humvees anymore, but you're no longer in your vehicle. That thing is just a rock on the road. Now you have just you, your soldiers, your disciplined initiative, your commander's intent present in your mind, and you have to go up and you have to, you know, kick butt and take names and do it with whatever you have on your hands and the experience and the knowledge that you've developed over the years to lead men into combat.
I think after hearing you guys talk, you know, it's about adaptability. When we went, and you guys have way more experience than I do, but when the war first started, global war on terror, one of the number one things that we came in contact with that we hadn't seen before were IEDs, right? And that was a massive killer for us. It was kind of a technology thing, but we just didn't understand that they had that capability. We do understand watching Ukraine. That's what we're learning from, you know, these articles and the news and things, is that the things that they are using. But imagine if we didn't have that, and then we just step in, and then now these drones dropping these bombs into our tanks are now those new form of IEDs. So, I mean, it's all about adaptability. We just have to train the best we can on the basics to make sure that we can be proficient when we get there. That's what I take from what you guys are talking about. So,
no, you're right. And, you know, just in the lifespan of IEDs, as we learned them and went through that process, those continued to change as we would change our TTPs and how we would address them, even to the point where the enemy, and it wasn't complex technology either to build an IED and to detonate an IED. It was very, very simple, but it was very effective, right? And we were constantly addressing that issue through adaptability. For example, when one version of the IED called the EFP would be one initiator would be passive IR, which basically, you know, when your vehicle passed through that little infrared laser, it would initiate the EFP, and it was set to a time, so it would, you know, be a direct impact. And we developed what we call the Rhino system, where we would put down, you know, a little heat box, battery generated or whatnot, that would actually react the infrared passive IR but anyway, so that was a constant, you know, changing and adapting. But I can imagine in Ukraine right now, the same thing is happening as, you know, drones are adapting. You know, what are we doing to counter that technology as drones are coming in on us? What are we doing with our technology to utilize drones, right? With the AI technology. And again, we're talking adaptability, some innovation, and that comes through critical thinking, creative thinking, all the things we talk about in the ADP 6-22 and the Army Leader Requirements Model, right? Mm-hmm. And it comes through developing our soldiers, right? Through the institutional and the operational, but also making sure that there's some self-development in there as well, right? And so how do we get after self-development, I guess?
I was wondering if I could tap on you, Sergeant Blood, to maybe give me some sort of anecdote or experience of maybe a time where you exploited technology for mission success, or found a piece of technology that you didn't expect that you had to overcome.
Yeah. So I have a really good one about this, actually. I'm glad you asked. So in 2015, I think it was my second or third deployment, we did an operation and we were going after I forget exactly which country he was classically educated in, but we eventually found out, we didn't know this at the time, probably would have informed our decision a little bit, but he ended up being a classically trained electrical engineer. I don't remember the country he trained in, but we were in Afghanistan and we came across this IED builder's house. And at first it just ended up being a gunfight. We took contact on the way in. I think we foot marched like 30K to get there. We wanted to really make sure we were outside of the bird's like signature. So the enemy couldn't hear us. So we walked all this distance, took us 2 days to get there. And when we got there, all of the women and children and the livestock had left, and it was only fighters, in the area. Somehow they saw us or got observation on us in some capacity. So we get there, we're gunfighting all night. And then by the time daybreak comes, I started going around and doing my sensitive site exploitation. And I started finding ordnance stacked up everywhere. And then I also started finding IED components. And not only was it IED components, it was pallets of IED components packaged, just like industry packages them, boxes of, plastic sealed circuit boards that they were like professionally printed. There were IC chip controller programmers that, up is one and down is zero. And he was programming them using like binary language. It's all stuff I don't quite understand. I'm not a programmer, right? But the output of all of that was a switch that we found called the Doom switch. And it hadn't been seen in Afghanistan. It had been seen in Iraq previously. And it had the capacity for something like 12 switch ports. And what that means to an EOD tech is there could be 12 different ways that it could be set up to kill you. There were monitored blasting caps and monitored batteries. So that means that any of my procedures that I would use to disrupt it would set it off instead. So it's anti-EOD as well. There was passive infrared, which Sergeant Major Duncan talked about. It could be armed or fired using a radio. So you could either arm it from a distance. It was also armed or fired by low-flying aircraft or tactical vehicles driving by via use of a vibration switch from a car alarm, and a bunch of other switch types as well. So what it comes down to is if one of these would have been implemented on the battlefield, because all these were found in storage configuration, if they were used in the battlefield, there's not really anything we could do about it, is kind of what we came up with. We could drop the building after CDE considerations and stuff. That's collateral damage estimate considerations. But there wasn't really anything we could do about it. So what we did was we gathered up as many of these things as we could. We gathered up as many of the circuit boards as we could. And we filled this chest with 300 pounds of, IED components, all cleared by me before they went on aircraft or anything. It's very important. And then took them back, and they exploited these over the next like 18 months and gave us information about them. And that information driving process is forgotten about often, because sometimes it's like, okay, yeah, we need to make this timeline. We need to go. But if you find things like that, and those are being found right now all the time, right? You see it with the Russian, the POM variants, the POM 3, the POM 2S, these are landmine variants that if you walk up to them, they detonate basically. And understanding that technology when it's found is very important, because it can drive tactical movements on the ground. It can change the way that commanders are going to move troops if you understand the technology being used against you, which is something we've talked about extensively here. But yeah, so finding the Doom switch was something that we communicated to commanders, especially the AO commander. And once we found it, if there was information that was going to be on the ground, we took a different approach. And that adaptability thing that we've been talking about is very important, right? Finding what the threat is, finding out what it can actually do, not turning it into a ghost story or, you know, a monster under the bed, but actually understanding it and then mitigating the threat, you know, directly, I think is very important. I kind of gave you the long-winded answer there. But yeah, it's a pretty good one. Yeah. The doom switch, it was a doozy.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I was wondering, Sergeant Major, I'll throw it to you too. Did you have an experience like that?
Finding a piece of technology that
you had to adapt to.
That we had to adapt to. Yeah. I mean, and again, in one of my deployments in Iraq, you could argue the tactic, I would say, of snipers, right? At first, when we went there, snipers were not very common, right? So this isn't a very technological piece because I already kind of talked about the IEDs. So
they weren't good either.
What's that?
They weren't. I got firsthand experience that they weren't grid shots.
No, they weren't.
So I'm so glad to say that.
And actually, from one deployment to another, I did notice that they got better in their training, right? And it was difficult to find them. So we came up, you know, we would analyze their TTPs, and then we would develop something that would help us either prevent or identify where, you know, because reacting to a sniper is very difficult. And so there were systems that were developed with microphones, and it would kind of pinpoint where the sniper was coming from. But I guess my point is we had to adapt to that TTP because they weren't up in a bell tower. You know, they'd be in a vehicle platform, for instance, and they'd be mobile, right? And so they would take out the back seat of a vehicle and take out the taillight, and then the shooter would be laying in the vehicle and then would take their shot and then move, and then take another shot and then move. So you can imagine how difficult that would be. And I want to say, you know, we had a system, and I think it was, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't want to say this, I think it was called the Warlock system. And it was basically a boom mic system on your Humvee that would pick up the sound, and it could detect where that sound was coming from and then give you real-time data of where it was. So you could kind of say, hey, sniper, 12 o'clock, you know, 400 meters, and we could react in some sort of appropriate manner. But I don't know if that's a great example, but that's one way we had to adapt to that tactic. Yeah.
Sergeant Major, there's an important part of that I think is overlooked sometimes too, and that is what we said at the beginning, right, is snipers originally were bad at this, right? Like they just were. When the conflict started, especially the GWAT, like they were not very good. And then as it progressed, when I deployed in 2018, we were held down by a sniper for upwards of 4 hours, and it was anytime we moved, you know, rounds would crack overhead. We ended up having to call in air support on, you know, we didn't exactly know where he was. We knew the area was abandoned minus, you know, that person. So we had quite a few liberties that we could take on dropping bombs, but the enemy is adapting as well. Right. And, this is in the case of near peer. It's in it's the case with the GWAT. We are not the only people who are adapting. So if we are not better and faster at adaptation, we are going to lose the adaptation fight. And then we have to compensate with technology or something. But I think it's better just to adapt more quickly, have the intelligence process drive our TTPs. And then we just have to be better and faster to survive. So.
Absolutely.
If I could too, I think you encapsulated the whole idea behind this article. You know, it's like you're learning, what we're talking about here is learning about Russia's TTPs so that you're able, today's NCOs are able to counter them or think ahead and know what to expect. Although like Sergeant Blood said, you know, they're going to advance just like we are. And they're watching, you know, our TTPs. Well, they were watching our TTPs while we were fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. So they kind of know a lot of things about us too. But I think it's important that anybody who's listening to this reads our articles, you know, that you challenge your soldiers to think and to think critically. And just from what you were saying too, Sergeant Blood, based on your story, as far as your experience in Afghanistan, is that as far as when soldiers are out there, they have to use their intellect, they have to use their mental agility to not just assume that something is just, you know, okay, we're just going to let it go or whatever and just forget about it. This is important to somebody. Obviously, EOD needed to know all about that, but if there wasn't an EOD tech there, would it have had as much importance to somebody else, somebody who's an infantryman who doesn't really know anything about this stuff? So again, it's good to, you need to employ your mental, your intellect, your mental agility, and try to discern, you know, and learn from the things that you experience and you see and that are happening out there.
Chago, that's a great point too. And you mentioned getting the information, right? Doing it quickly. Sergeant Major Duncan, you talked about the discipline initiative. One thing, and you know, being part of the Harding Project is great because I get to go out and talk to soldiers about this, but the doctrine and PME processes are slow. And they're slow on purpose because they have to be so well thought out. They have to be developed before they go out to the masses. But they are slow. So often when they get published, the information that many soldiers, and especially on the enlisted side, rely on is outdated, sometimes very outdated. So one way to get ahead of that, and this is something that I say on outreach trips all the time, but the Army's journal, the NCO journal, all the other branch journals, and the ones kind of on the periphery, they publish almost daily, right? And there's most of the information. I didn't know this before. You know, now I have a selfish reason to read everything that's published, and that's why I can recommend articles to the Chief of Staff of the Army so he can recognize authors. But before I started reading all of the articles, I didn't know how much information there was out there, especially about modern conflict and things that are developing and all these technologies we've been talking about. All that information is out there. And it's available. It's a lot more available than it is on social media. Social media has its place for sure. But in a journal, in a professional journal, what you get is you get information that's well thought out, well structured, and that has most of those, you know, because an author, if they're writing and they don't like something, they're like, oh, that doesn't really say what I, you know, what I want it to, they'll line it out and they'll put what they mean in there. Just one of the benefits. But yeah, it's a lot faster. It outpaces doctrine and PME and is a really good way for people to get their information to stay up to date.
We very much appreciate having both of you on this episode. I think we're getting close to the wrap time. I wanted to ask one final question to the both of you. And that would be, what is the major takeaway from this article, from your experiences, that you want to give to the NCOs or the soldiers that are listening? And I'll start with you, Sergeant Blood.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I would say is just the fact that the information is available publicly, right? So I'm going to kind of get away from, you know, the article specifics, because I want to challenge people to go out and read it themselves, because there's going to be a lot more useful stuff than just the one thing that I pick. But the fact that the information is out there is holistically important to the process. So get out there and read it, and also do some research on drones, because it is terrifying that, you know, in one square mile, there can be 800 drone threats, which is something that I read, not from this article, but separately. It's terrifying. Go read about it.
Yep. Just to kind of go off what Sergeant Blood's saying is pay attention to what is going on right now in Russia, Ukraine. And the way you can do that is finding articles that are writing about it and bring them down to your squad. Let's read this article. Let's what are they talking about here? And then have a discussion with everybody. Get everybody to get that understanding of what's really going on. And then maybe have like an internal AR. Is this something that you would do? Or do you think we have, with our capabilities that you understand, how would you get after this? And just start having those discussions and having some mental reps and implement these things into your training. Whether it's, you know, just taking the squad out into the wood line and let's work on this, you know, this example of what we just read. But I would say my message is pay attention to what's going on, because it's quite an advantage that we have, that we can look at this from the outside and look in, and we can almost armchair quarterback things at this point. And that way, when we find ourselves in that situation, we're more prepared and we're ready.
Sergeant Major and Sergeant Blood, thank you for joining us. And a thank you to our audience. Remember to put your knowledge to the page, submit articles, and get published with the NCO Journal. Don't forget to check out our webpage and follow us on social media. We'll catch you next time on the NCO Journal Podcast.